So he will talk to us about two important pioneers this morning, and I'm really glad you've done that. Thanks.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm talking about two good friends of mine, the last of whom passed away last July 7th, Dorley Jarmel Soria, who was 101 at that point. And she had, if you figure out the arithmetic, she was born in December 1900. She actually began her life in the 19th century, if you're strict about chronology that way, and lived into the 21st, which is a good span of time. She had, among many distinctions, she was probably the last surviving participant in the first European tour of an American symphony orchestra, the New York Philharmonic's 1930 tour with Arturo Toscanini, for which she was director of publicity. And if one accepts that, excuse me, that I've said that already, my reason for speaking here about Dorley really isn't about that, but her Italian-born husband Dario Soria. It has to do with their distinctive niche in the history of classical musical recording. Raised in musical families on opposite sides of the Atlantic, they met and married in New York, becoming a team in work as in life. And their work in commercial recordings fell into three distinctive phases, successively. First, the Chaitra Soria label, initially a distributor of 78s, primarily operatic and vocal, imported from Chaitra in Italy. With the introduction of the LP, the label focused on complete opera recordings, becoming in the early 50s the largest single catalog of such recordings. Second came the Angel label, established by EMI to take over the American distribution of the British Columbia label after their licensing agreement with CBS American Columbia had lapsed. Here, the Soria's ideas about marketing and presentation of classical recordings were first tried out on a large scale. And third, the Soria series, a deluxe art-packaged series of special recordings for RCA, mostly new, but including a few reissues. But before telling that story, let me trace their earlier lives, which had some bearing on the directions they would follow in the recording industry. Let's start with Dorley Jarmel, as she was for 42 years, until her 1942 marriage to Dario Soria. For this, I'm going to draw extensively on her own words, including an autobiographical sketch she herself prepared out of her long experience with musical journalism to assist the writers of her obituary. Her files and other sources have yielded additional documents as well as some fascinating photos. I was to have included a recording, some recordings of her voice. I regret to say that it's something that I'm sure some of you may have done before. I neglected after putting the CD in the player to check the incipits of all these excerpts. I neglected to put it back in the container, and the CD is still in New York. I'm sorry about that, but I'll reconstruct some of the information. A native of New York, she attended the Columbia School of Journalism and found employment there while still at school, contributing to a syndicated newspaper series entitled Master Lovers of the World. And for Love Story magazine, she rewrote British romances with such titles as His Liege Lady and Her Highness's Double to tailor them for the American market. At the memorial program last fall for her, I mentioned these and said I doubted that they still survived, and her heirs came up to me afterwards and told me, yes, they are there in the estate. I haven't gotten around to reading them yet. In her third-person description of her beginnings, I quote, "She had always loved music. She had been taken to the Metropolitan as a child, had attended the Damrosch Young People's Concerts, had studied the violin with more passion than talent. When she submitted to the Musical Digest an article called Arts Esperanto, It was accepted by its editor, Pierre V.R. Key, who added, "I should be pleased to have you telephone for an appointment." And so, after graduation and a year abroad, Dolly Jarmel found herself at the Musical Digest, interviewing artists, covering concerts, reviewing music books, and soon being appointed managing editor. There she met a man who was to become a lifelong friend, the former secretary of Caruso, who eventually was to become a manager of the Philharmonic, and he was then the magazine's advertising manager, Bruno Zirato. And it was through Zirato's influence that she was put on the prized door list of the Metropolitan Opera. Continuing the quotation, "From the Digest, she moved to the staff of Musical America. Then her life was changed when Arthur Judson, the country's most powerful concert and orchestra manager, engaged her to work for him. Since Mr. Judson then was head of his own concert bureau, later to merge with others into Columbia Concerts, as well as manager of the New York Philharmonic Symphony, its former title, and its outdoor summer series, Stadium Concerts, she automatically became press head for all three. Later, she also became special assistant in charge of programs to Mrs. Charles S. Guggenheimer, the stadium's chairman." End of the quotation. Not bad for a young lady who was not yet 30. Dorley would remain at the Philharmonic until 1953, and in her early years there played a significant role in shaping the public image of Toscanini, particularly when the Philharmonic made that famous tour in May and June 1930. Although the maestro had visited Vienna and Berlin with the La Scala Opera the year before, neither Britain nor the rest of Europe had ever heard him in person up to that point. So this was an historic event. And the tapes, the interview I spoke about that we don't have, was taken in 1965 for a series on NBC called Toscanini, the Man Behind the Legend. The unedited tapes of those were found by Seth Winner at the Toscanini Legacy in the Rodgers and Hammerstein archives, and he edited them up for our use in the memorial last year. We have some photographs from Dorley's archives that relate to this tour. Okay, that. Here she is on the Ile-de-France, on the way over, oh, thank you, on the way across on the tour. And in the interview, she talked about being press agent for Toscanini. That was really no job at all, in one sense, because you just announced that Toscanini was conducting and everybody came, and it was sold out. But dealing with the European press was problematic because there were two things they wanted, of course, photographs and interviews. And Toscanini gave neither, period. That was that. She had to deal with all the questions they had, but I'm sure she dealt with them very, very well. Here is the next slide, shows Toscanini and Maurice von Prague, who was the orchestra manager, and there is Dorley at the right. And she also told about encountering George Bernard Shaw. Albert Coates, the Russian-born British conductor, was a friend of Shaw's, and she had known him for some time because he'd conducted at the stadium. So he asked, "Is there anything I can do for you while you're here in London?" And she said, "I'd love to meet Bernard Shaw." And Coates knew Shaw and said he could arrange that. And one day they drove out to Shaw's place. And she said, "I was imagining I would come away with millions of wonderful bon mots that I could dine out on for years." And Coates and Shaw spent the whole afternoon talking about their respective motor cars. But she did get a chance to invite Shaw to come if he was interested to hear the concerts. And Shaw asked, "Tell me, Seth, can you remember the word? Is this man, Toscanini, trustworthy and industrious?" And she said, "Oh, yes, he is very industrious." And Shaw said, "Well and good." And he came to the concert. She gave him the seat next to her own seat. And he showed up in a ratty old raincoat, and of course the concert, being in Britain, started with national anthems, the American and God Save the King. And everybody stood up, except the man sitting next to me, George Bernard Shaw. He refused to stand for the national anthem. And that was the end of that episode. The other anecdotes date from later and really have to be told by Dorley, so I'll pass on beyond them. Dorley and Dario remain... Oh, I have a couple more, actually, of in its own direction. There's a Dorley and Toscanini in Salzburg in 1935, and NBC picked up by shortwave some of the Toscanini concerts in Salzburg. There's another pose. She knew better than to try to steal the picture from Toscanini. She, all these pictures, she's got that hat on, and you don't really see her. She was a very good press agent. This is in 1937 when she was there to help with the publicity for broadcasts again. This is dated 19, March 3rd, 1940. My dear Dorley, guess who is this young man? And it seems to have been, we think it was taken at the Villa Pauline, where Toscanini resided in sometimes when he was in New York. Dorley and Dario as well remained friendly with Toscanini for the rest of Maestro's life. And in the summer of 1954, when Angel was recording Verdi's La Forza del Destino in Milan with Maria Callas and Richard Tucker, they visited him at the Isolino San Giovanni on Lago Maggiore, where Toscanini had a summer home. And there were some wonderful pictures taken then, and I have a couple of them. Here we see the conductor Carlo Maria Giulini on the left, and Toscanini, and that's Dario Soria on the right. Perhaps we should have a little less light in the hall, if possible. Some of these would have more clarity. And from the same visit, here's a different assemblage. From left to right, a gentleman we've not yet identified, and that the first lady there from the left, rather, is Vali Toscanini, the conductor's daughter, the Countess Castelbarco, and Dorley Soria, Richard Tucker, the great American tenor. At this point, I'm not going to be able to read my script. The picture looks great. Up, I'll need some more light than that. And that's Tucker's wife, Sarah, and that's Dorley's mother and Dario. A unique feature of this picture, perhaps, is it's certainly the only one picture of Richard Tucker I have ever seen where he was not wearing his hairpiece. He was informal and didn't realize these pictures would ever be seen, I guess. During her years at the Philharmonic, Dorley met and worked with most of the era's most famous artists. She was on hand for the orchestra's centennial, Leonard Bernstein's famous debut, the first post-war tour to Europe, and she became close friends with all the conductors, Barbaroli, Reiner, Zell, and Metropolis. And at Columbia, she promoted the American debuts of Horowitz, Milstein, Piatigorsky, Serkin, Kasatsu, Iturbi, and Franciscati, and practically everybody else. But she didn't not restrict herself to her circle of acquaintances to classical music. If this photo I found in the files is any indication, does anybody identify that gentleman? Yes, it's Jerome Kern. It says so on the back, but that's the only thing it says. It does not explain why this conjunction happened, whether she is... I don't think he would have chosen her to take musical dictation, because he didn't need anybody to do it, unlike some composers we know. But there it is. I didn't get a chance to call Gerald Boardman, who is here in this part of the world, and find out if he has any trace, but I'm going to follow that up. Life in concert management also had its lighter side. This picture that turned up in her files says it's a Columbia Artists Party, mid-1930s. Dorley is clearly the Valkyrie standing just behind the Brunhilde, who's kneeling before Wotan in the foreground. And I don't know whether the Wotan is, in fact, Arthur Judson himself or what, but I hope someday to get an explanation of this one, too. Let me turn now to Dario Soria, who was born in Rome in 1912. And we discover that music was also central to his early life. In a 1978 interview, he recalled his youth for Opera News editor Robert Jacobson. As a child in Rome, Grand Opera was like a familiar neighbor, part of daily living. From the windows of the house where we lived, I could see the Castel Sant'Angelo. Every Italian schoolboy learns that it was the Emperor Hadrian's tomb. But to me, it was a stage set, the terrace from which Tosca jumped to her death. In my family, there was always talk of opera, and artists were often guests at home. My father and uncle had as friends and clients many singers and composers, among them Mascagni, Giordano, Zandonai, and Respighi. And indeed, portraits of all these composers and of others inscribed to Dario's father and uncle were arrayed around the piano in the Soria's New York apartment. Dario's family owned a private bank in Rome, and the heir was trained in economics, commercial sciences, and law. Only late in the 1930s did Mussolini, at Hitler's behest, begin actively persecuting Italy's Jews. And so at the age of 27, Dario came to the United States, where he found a job managing the Italian Pavilion restaurant at the New York World's Fair. With America's entry into World War II, his linguistic skills became useful to the Office of War Information, and he later worked in radio at CBS. In the course of all this, he met Dorley Jarmel, and they were married in 1942. Recordings actively entered the Soria's lives in 1945, at the end of the war. And here I'm going to draw on an account drafted by Dorley as background for an article printed in Hi-Fi Review in 1959 over the byline of Warren DeMott. But I'll quote from the original draft from her files. "We started in the recording business by chance. Dario, then with CBS, took a 2 months leave in the autumn of 1945 to join a semi-official trade mission to Italy, the first after the war. He planned while there to look around for new program ideas for radio. Bob Smith, an executive of MCA who was in charge of one of the radio shows and a passionate record collector, asked Dario to bring back some interesting discs. In the course of investigating these records, Dario met the top people of Cetra, and as an experiment, arranged to have a few hundred Cetra records shipped to New York for sale in the States. The first album made musical news. It contained 8 sides of operatic arias sung by a rising young tenor named Tagliavini, whose name had been heralded by American GIs returning from Italy. There was then no thought of presentation. The product was the thing, exciting recordings of a post-war crop of Italian artists then unknown in America. Tagliavini, Tassinari, Pagliughi, Stignani, Chloe Elmo, Cesare Siepi, Italo Taio, etc. Plus some full-length opera recordings and a Mozart Requiem conducted by De Sabata. The Cetra office was then the Soria living room. Cetra office hours were evenings and Sundays at home." That's the end of the direct quote. Dario realized that there was a potentially significant business here, but due to a shellac shortage in Europe, he wasn't getting record stock fast enough from Cetra, so he arranged to import matrices and press the recordings here. And at this point, according to Dorley, the Sorias first became interested in the presentation of their recordings. I quote, "We had become attached to the label and wanted to make it look as good as it sounded. We experimented with lettering and with colored papers, with old Italian designs to frame titles of old Italian music. One of our inspirations in those innocent days was the discovery of a wallpaper sample with a design of deliciously paired red cherries. We appropriated it for the cover of the Tagliavini Tassinari album of opera love duets, which featured, naturally, the cherry duet from L'Amico Fritz." Then in 1948, Columbia introduced the LP record, bringing turmoil to the industry. Dario quickly grasped the new format's significance for recorded opera. Chaitra had already imported the first, more or less complete recording of Verdi's La Forza del Destino on 1878 in two hefty albums. And Dario arranged with Columbia's Edward Wallerstein to adopt the new technology, beginning with that Forza, which was downsized with a couple of cuts to two LPs. Equally important, he established a new source of product that would give Chaitra Soria that large catalog of complete operas. As he told it in 1978, we made an arrangement with Radio Italiana, asking them to negotiate with the unions and the principals. It was the 50th anniversary of Verdi's death, and they were doing all his operas. With Mario Labrocca, then head of classical programs, we went to the unions and said that without additional rehearsals and work, we would like to have permission to record everything they were doing. Then we would listen, the conductor having the ultimate say, and if it was considered artistically worthwhile after remaking problem spots, we would publish it. We wanted a general contract so we would not have to renegotiate each time. It was a very simple invention, and it was well received by everyone. Now Dorley takes up the story. Up until that time, Chaitra Soria records were released in the typical pocket-type albums used by all companies. We decided to put our LP records into boxes, attractive dustproof boxes. It was then that Edward Wallerstein asked to see Dario. He pointed indignantly to one of the new Chaitra Soria boxes and said, "Young man, you can't do this. You will ruin the industry. We are here to make money in records. We are not here to make money for box manufacturers." But Dario persevered with his boxes, which were soon adopted by Columbia and almost everyone else. In 1948, Dario left CBS. He had left CBS to join an advertising agency, working on such Verdian entertainments as the Spike Jones and Edgar Berg and Charlie McCarthy shows. 2 years later, with the extensive Radio Italiana Complete Verdi project underway, he resigned to devote himself full-time to Chaitra Soria. He was in the record business. Dorley continued at the Philharmonic, but that association would also end soon. Due to tensions arising from the introduction of the LP and EMI's initial reluctance to adopt the new medium, American Columbia decided to replace its international partner with a new one. Philips in Holland eventually got the nod. And this left the British Columbia catalog without an American outlet. So, having finally embraced the LP, EMI decided to set up its own American affiliate and approached the Sorias to head it. They couldn't resist. Dorley resigned from her Philharmonic post and her Columbia concerts also, and Dario arranged to sell Chaitra Soria to Capitol Records. To name the new label, the Sorias rummaged around in EMI's history, settling finally on the Recording Angel tracing sound with a stylus, the image that had predated Nipper on some gramophone company recordings. As Dorley reports, first we took the angel and improved its looks. To the sad little Victorian cherub, we married a gay Verrocchio cherub from Florence and produced the charming angel, which became the trademark of Angel Records. Here is the angel office, and there is the model of the angel trademark at the right, and angel covers in the back. We'll see another picture very like this fairly soon. Dorley also devised imaginative publicity stratagems. She put a want ad in various publications. Wanted, Angel Records, pressed 1898 to 1906. Old recordings with Recording Angel, cherub seated on disc tracing sound with stylus. She reports that she was flooded with ancient records from collectors. Curiosity was aroused, and the name of Angel spread. She was a very skillful publicity person, and the ads, I wish I had been able to reproduce them, the streamer ads that they ran in the Sunday Times and in other publications, there's a bound volume of them, which two-color ads that would announce all the releases for each month, and they were really, with quotations and slogans of various kinds. She invented the champagne opera title to go with operetta title to go with Lehar and Strauss works with with Schwarzkopf and Geda and so on. Wait a minute. Angel was launched in 1953. Aside from the quality of the artists and repertory, its biggest innovations came in the realm of packaging. Utilizing EMI's international reach, the records were pressed in England, the art and production department was in Paris, and the final product was assembled and factory sealed in New York. This last was a significant move. LPs were still sampled in stores, resulting in damaged discs that exasperated customers and dealers. The Angel, quote, perfectionist package was sealed in cellophane, which attracted attention, guaranteed the freshness of the disc, and protected the beautiful covers from Paris, most of them printed on matte paper. However, as Dorley noted, since the dealer still demanded demonstration records, we also issued the catalog in a simple unsealed jacket with no pretense at packaging, which later developed into the less expensive standard package. It was a kind of plain brown wrapper with a band around the spine, giving the titling and the ID. No program notes either. Here, as elsewhere, the Sauriers' respective backgrounds in music publicity and advertising stimulated them to rethink existing practices. I could spend quite a lot of time showing you classic Angel LP covers, a time that we don't really have, but I will show you a couple of my favorites from the early Angel days. Here, this is a Raoul Dufy painting, the red violin, Le Violon Rouge, for André Gertler's performances of the two 20th century masterpieces, the Berg Concerto and the Bartok Solo Violin Sonata. It's a very striking image indeed. For a three-disc set to commemorate the 25th anniversary of Diaghilev's death, the usual fold-over leaflet became a lavish booklet illustrated with set designs, photos, and other memorabilia, much of it from the then-private collection of Boris Kochno, the impresario secretary. Here's the cover of the booklet featuring Picasso's design for the drop curtain of Erik Satie's ballet Parade, of which the first recording actually was included in this album. With the La Scala recordings, they took an institutional approach. These were complete operas from the first extensive series of complete operas from La Scala. And since these were authorized, they could use the company's trademark design for its posters and printed matter to emphasize the fact that these were the first official ones. A major feature of nearly all the Scala recordings, of course, was the operatic sensation of the early 50s, the great Greek-American diva Maria Callas, who had made her first recordings for Chaitra, and the Sauriers knew her, and I have always suspected that that was one of the reasons EMI wanted to get them in the fold, because Walter Legg had his eye on Callas, and to some extent Dario's previous work with her must have had. He was a very suave gentleman, very courtly, and of course he spoke Italian, and she was always very comfortable with him, with both of them. They both spoke Italian. And they arranged a ball, an Angel ball, to follow her American debut in Chicago as Norma, and they were bringing out a recording of Norma at the time. And a couple of years later, when she made her New York debut at the Met, there was another party afterwards, and I did find a picture of this in the files. From the right, from the left, that's Francis Robinson, the Met's assistant manager and longtime feature of the intermission features there, and Dorley. And that's the Italian ambassador, Manlio Brosio, and Maria. And I suspect that what gentleman that you can't see much of is probably Dario, and I don't know whose back we are seeing in the front. Callas, of course, gave the label an enormous lift, the publicity that went with her. And the records, even when she canceled, the records kept selling. In fact, the cancellations probably helped the sale of the records sometimes. Mm-hmm. Despite its imposing roster of musicians, which included Karajan, Schwarzkopf, Geda, Gieseking, Klemperer, and so on, and its distinctive packaging, the Angel honeymoon eventually began to fade. Dorley describes one aspect of the problem. Our lovely covers from Paris were becoming more and more austere, more elegant in lettering and design, but less obviously appealing to the public. Our sales representatives pointed this out to us. We promised to try to do something about it. Other classical labels by that time were emphasizing brighter colors and more modern graphics and glossy photographs, usually print. Everything was printed on coated papers and had a little more glamour and zing to it instead of the matte textures of the Angel packages. Dorley picks up the story. On our next Paris visit, I put the problem to the art director, Monsieur Cassandre, a brilliant but sardonic and rather terrifying person. I explained that our covers were becoming dimmer and dimmer. There was too much brown, too much taupe, too much mustard color. Monsieur Cassandre turned on me a jaundiced, mustard-colored eye and said, Madame n'aime pas la moutarde, moi j'aime la moutarde. I quickly abandoned the matter of mustard and murmured that the covers, which were not of a brownish cast, tended to be of various shades of gray. This time I was truly annihilated. After 50 years as a painter, Monsieur Cassandre assured me, he had learned one thing. There is only one color, one beautiful color, that is gray. In the end, of course, there was a compromise between our commercial demands and Monsieur Cassandre's impeccable taste. Dario's own account, however, points to some other problems, probably more significant. To obtain American distribution for its popular records, EMI had bought Capitol. And naturally, this new affiliate soon far outstripped the sales of the classy classical Angel label. Although Dario had helped arrange the purchase, because he had known with the Capitol folks from having sold Tetris Oreo to them, he found that, in his words, Capitol resented that we, Angel, were so close to the English operation, and they eventually said we had to merge the two operations because it was a waste with dual distribution and so on. The accountants in the room will please forgive me for reading what Dario said next was, it was a typical accountant's reasoning on both sides. So the English board decided to merge the two companies. I had a contract and preferred shares of Angel stock with an option for EMI to buy. We found ourselves in the minority on the merger, so I resigned and EMI exercised its option. I felt Angel would be diluted in purpose, but it managed to survive remarkably well. Dorley was heartbroken. It was like losing a child. But it would have been a terrible compromise to be the classical division of Capitol. It was a matter of pride. So they resigned on January 1st, 1958. Dario, in talking of this, defined what seemed to be the Soria's basic philosophy of record making. To preserve and publish things that are not done otherwise. I've always believed in publishing records of works for which there was some demand, not just for a scholarly purpose, and if you are first with something of artistic merit, then there will be people to support it. And at this point, indeed, another label proved willing to support this idea and employ the Soria's entrepreneurial and presentational talents, but in a more limited and specialized way. Dorley's account tells us that George Marek, head of RCA Victor Records, approached us with a highly interesting proposal to develop and package, as independent producers, a special Soria series of gala classical record albums to be distributed through RCA's regular channels, including its record clubs. As the Sorias had already committed themselves to help Giancarlo Menotti organize and launch the first Festival of Two Worlds at Spoleto in Italy, that the beginning of the RCA project was postponed until 1959. And here's a picture of the Soria series office, and it looks, as I said, remarkably similar to the Angel office, except we've got a dog instead of an angel. And this was the official photograph, and it was widely circulated at the time. For several years, the Soria series brought forth multiple LP sets and some singles, packaged in handsome boxes or slipcases with textured covers. A collaboration with the great Swiss art publisher Skira produced splendid color reproductions of artworks that were tipped onto the covers and into the liner booklets, also printed by Skira. Many of these recordings became and remain classics. The operas, including the Carrion Price di Stefano Tosca, the Leinsdorf Riesenek, Ariadne auf Naxos, and the Seraphine Vickers Otello, were illustrated with reproductions of set designs in full for the world premiere productions in full color. And here is for the front of the slipcase for the Ariadne recording, and that's one of those designs that was embossed into the cloth-covered slipcase. Oratorios, including Beecham's third recording of Messiah, notoriously unhistorical, but also pretty irresistible, a Rainer Verdi Requiem, and a Munch Berlioz Requiem were adorned with apposite religious paintings. For Rainer's recording of Strauss's Don Quixote, original art was commissioned from Salvador Dali, and the booklet for the first recording of Poulenc's monodrama La Voix Humaine was graced with drawings by Jean Cocteau, the author of the librettist, of the libretto. Here is the front cover of that. This was not the outside of the box. This was the booklet inside. And this was, no, sorry, wrong direction. This is the rear. And there is the Soria series logo, which Dario had designed, and which he actually owned when they left RCA. He still had owned that and used it, as we will see. Although most of the Soria recordings were new productions, there were a few reissues. And I don't think Sam knew that there was a Philadelphia connection in this talk, but one of the reissues was the first ever release of Toscanini's Philadelphia recording of Schubert's great C major symphony. And since in those years Vladimir Horowitz was not playing concerts and making few new recordings, the Sorias put together the Horowitz collection, in which the pianist's notable collection of 20th century art ornamented a selection of his older recordings. That's the front of the box of that, with a tipped-in Picasso. Eventually, however, market pressures, stemming mainly from discount record dealers, cut so deeply into RCA's profit margins that the extra expenses for packaging and color printing and commissioned art and literature were not covered, and the Soria series was quietly wound down. The recordings survived in the catalog, but the packaging was simplified when existing stock exhausted. Through the 1960s, Dario was vice president in RCA's international liaison department, and his business and diplomatic skills were invaluable as RCA made itself into an international label in Europe and Asia. In 1971, he became executive director of the Metropolitan Opera Guild and put this valuable organization, originally a volunteer operation, into a much more efficient and professional state, and added new merchandising and educational initiatives. Dorley wasn't idle during this time. As Shirley Fleming, then as now editor of Musical America, noted in her vivid obituary of Dorley, she began writing a column for the Carnegie Hall program, and in the mid-60s was eventually lured into shifting this activity to High Fidelity Musical America, when she entered this writer's life. And continuing Shirley, whizzed into it might be a better term, for Dorley moved fast, thought fast, talked fast, worked fast. As editor of Musical America, I was in close touch with her, often by phone, and her words poured out in such a rapid stream I found myself gripping the receiver with both hands, just hanging on to keep abreast. By the time I'd absorbed one of her ideas, she was already two or three ahead. She was a tiny woman whom you might have thought frail until you saw her in motion or until you noticed the animation in her dark eyes. She lived four blocks from Musical America offices, and she always delivered her copy in person, sometimes through sleet, storms, or pouring rain, despite the fact that we told her to stay home. Along the way in Dorley's variegated columns, the careful reader might detect the breadth and depth of her knowledge and her appreciation of literature and art, as well as music. And certainly no reader could miss her ever-lively fascination with people, their genius, their foibles, and their individuality. Here's a characteristic excerpt from a 1966 column. T.S. Eliot, who wrote that the naming of cats is a difficult matter, never had to cope with the naming of violinists, which is a different matter since you can't tell if a child is going to be a great fiddler until he's at least four. But certain names seem to help. Russian names, biblical names, exotic names. Names like Misha and Yasha, David and Igor, Isaac and Nathan, and Joseph Yehudi Zeno. Who, for instance, would have guessed that a boy with a name like James Oliver Buswell IV, a name almost as impressive as A.A. Milne's James Morrison Morrison Weatherby George Dupree, would become a violinist? Well, he did. And at 18, after playing with two major orchestras in New York this winter, he received this accolade from Harold Schoenberg. Here is a musician born to play the violin. In 1972, while traveling with Dorley in the Far East, Dario suffered a heart attack. And in 1978, he retired from the Opera Guild. But he continued as producer of the Met's annual historic broadcast recordings, which became the final home of the Soria Series logo. The booklets there may have been less lavish than those for Angel and RCA, but they were still done with a great deal of style. Here's the cover of one for a Flagstad Melchior Tristan broadcast of 1941. He also worked at organizing and augmenting the Met's archive of its broadcasts, preserving them and making them available to listeners at the Performing Arts Library next door, a process that still continues. He died in 1980 while working with engineer Tom Owen in the sound restoration studio at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives on a 1940 broadcast of Verdi's Un ballo in maschera. And the Met asked Dorley and me to carry on with the series. This account may make the Soria sound like workaholics. True, they did work hard, and they additionally volunteered their skills and energies in many worthy causes, notably the founding and funding of the Toscanini Memorial Archives in the Music Division at the New York Public Library, which is devoted to microfilms of composers' original manuscripts. But they also found time for leisure at a country home in Connecticut and enjoyed a wide circle of friends, both inside and out of music. Their parties were legendary, including an annual New Year's Day festival and others in honor of visiting musicians from abroad. Dorley lived on for more than 20 years after Dario's death. She kept up her column for a while, contributed to Opera News now and then, and wrote a short guidebook to the new Metropolitan Opera House. She traveled to Europe frequently, visiting such friends as William Weaver, who lived in Italy, Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, and Henri-Louis de Lagrange, the Mahler scholar, sometimes visiting him in Paris and sometimes at Toblach, where he had his summer festival of Mahler. She donated her letters from Toscanini and Callas to the Music Division of the New York Public Library. And since her death, I've been working with the executors and all of the historically significant material in her files, which is voluminous, is going to end up in appropriate archival collections in New York, the Philharmonic Archives, the Met Archives, the Music Division, and the Rodgers and Hammerstein Divisions of the Public Library. In December 1990, a group of friends gave Dorley a party. It was on her 90th birthday, although that fact was never mentioned. And the guest list was international, including Irving Berlin's three daughters, and Henri-Louis de Lagrange, and the soprano Daisy Halban, whom some of you will remember, recorded Mahler with Bruno Walter, and whose mother was a Mahler singer. And we have a couple of slides from that rather happy occasion. This shows Dorley in front. Alton Peters, who was a lawyer and opera enthusiast, who was secretary of the Met Board and president of the Opera Guild. Behind Dorley is William Weaver, and at the right is the Flaubert and other, the literary biographer Francis Stiegmüller, who was also a long-time friend of the Sorias. And in this picture, at the left is Betty Chapin, and her husband, Schuyler Chapin, a manager of the Met, once, as we've heard, at Columbia Records. And there's Alton Peters again, and on the right is Ismail Merchant of the team of Merchant and Ivory, who were also among Masuria's many friends. You will have noticed in this the emphasis on presentation in the Soria's work. They were not record producers in anything like the usual sense of the word. Though they did make proposals about repertory and artists, the actual sessions were handled by the production staffs at respectively Radio Italiana, EMI, mainly Walter Legg, RCA, Richard Moore, and Jack Pfeiffer, and others. But they had a flair for the visual. Dario was experienced in financial planning and production, and Dorley drew on enormous experience in promoting concerts and dealing with the musical press, as well as, of course, incredible contacts all over the musical world. Yet, from the history of these projects, I think one must reluctantly conclude that packaging and presentation didn't really pan out as an element in the classical LP market as it, quote, matured during the 50s and 60s. The kind of customers and the Tony record stores that displayed things to discriminating and well-heeled customers hadn't survived the onslaught of Sam Goody and the like, and with them eventually went the kind of natural forum in the marketplace for this kind of packaging. Clearly, its term lasted about 10 years from the founding of Angel until the closing down of the Soria series. It's partly, I would suppose, the European-oriented aspect of it was part of it, the visual art. Still, that's the spirit of this has lived on in a whole lot of different ways. I would certainly assert that the booklet that we put together for the Maples and Cylinders in the Rodgers and Hammerstein edition of the Maples and Cylinders was very much influenced by the kind of ideals of documentation and presentation that the Sorias had in mind. We didn't do it in an art format. We did it in a historical format with aggressively old pictures, an enormous amount of detail and fact, because people who would be interested in those recordings would be interested in that kind of stuff too. It doesn't necessarily follow, it seems, from the marketplace that people who are interested in Berlioz's Requiem want Italian Renaissance art also. They don't need pictures of the Day of Wrath. Today, when I come across a Bear family package, I tend to think of the Sorias. This is one way it's going on. The CD has been a problem in this respect because, of course, as a format, it does not lend itself to the kind of display. But unless you adopt this large package, we did the Met Historic broadcasts in that, and that kind of a large package for a long time, and with the jewel cases in frames in slots in a plastic insert. And the booklet stayed at 12 inches square, like the one you saw. But eventually we got so many complaints. People didn't have shelves to put those things on anymore. I don't know where they put their art books, but the fact was they wanted bricks. So for the last package, we have given them a brick, and we will continue to do so. It presents this visual standard. And with opera, the visual aspect, certainly there is something to be said for having some kind of splendor to it, and particularly when you're dealing with specific recordings of specific performances. It's pieces people like to see what they look like and to see what get some detail. And when you reduce the triumphal scene debt from Aida to 5 inches square, it's not awfully triumphal. But the idea of doing such things is still alive, and I think a lot is owed to the Sorias for having set an ideal and a standard for it. And of course, the whole business of complete opera records, I think it can be said that Dario jump-started that. The big companies went into it sooner and faster than they would have if Teatro Soria hadn't been there and gotten all those things out in the market and tended to frighten them into fearing they were preempted. In any case, speaking as a friend of theirs, they were a great ornament to the life that they led and to the profession that they took part in, and they will be very much missed. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, David.